welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
A story may not be factual, but it can be true. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn, and that describes the tales of the Hasidim, a Jewish tradition of storytelling. Welcome to the second in our Spiritual Classics series on the spirit of things here on ABC Radio National. There's no doctrine or law, no theological argument or list of commands, but a Hasidic tale sends a message that slips under the barrier between this world and the next. Here's one from a master storyteller, Donna Jacob Seif.
I was once asked, if I only had one story in the world, what would I tell? And this is the story that I would tell. It's a story about Rabbi Zuzia, who was a real rabbi, walked on this earth hundreds of years ago, and he was found weeping by his disciples. And his disciples were worried, and they asked him why he was crying. And Rabbi Zuzia said, I'm crying because I know what they will ask me when I stand at the gates of heaven. And the disciples were worried. They said, what will they ask? And Rabbi Zuzia said, when I stand at the gates of heaven, they won't ask me, Zuzia, why weren't you more like Abraham, or why weren't you more like Moses? They will say to me, Zuzia, why weren't you, Zuzia? There is something in the Hasidic tradition that gives honor to the fact that we are made in the image of God, whatever that may be. And because of that, we are imbued with unique gifts, and that our requirement in the world is to really discover those unique gifts, that quality that only we can give in worship to God and in the world at large. I get great comfort from that idea. And it's not just Hasidic. I've got to say it's also Jewish. In the Amida, an important Jewish prayer, it says, Elohai Avraham, Elohai Yitzhak, Elohai Yaakov, which is the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And the question is often asked, why not just say the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? And it's because each relationship is unique, and so it must be. So even in the Amida itself, the uniqueness of the relationship with God is preserved by that.
Donna Jacob Seif uses stories like that in her work as a counselor and a teacher, and she'll be back later with more from her repertoire of Hasidic tales. I've heard that one about Zuzia quoted many times by Christians and Buddhists. It underlines why stories are such a powerful form of religious literature. In the 19th century, a particular kind of Jewish story took hold, which focused not on the figures of the Torah, but of the town and the humble shtetl or village where most Jews of Europe lived. These became the tales of the Hasidim, which would have remained largely unknown were it not for the German Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, who collected them in the 1930s. One person who grew up in the Hasidic tradition and became an exponent of it is Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi. He's a bit of a rebel, and he'll join us later. But first, someone who's his opposite number, the chief rabbi of the UK, Jonathan Sacks, represents establishment orthodoxy. And yet, he too was profoundly affected by the Hasidic tradition, which is fervent, enthusiastic, and some might say, zealous, but he'll explain. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, welcome back to The Spirit of Things.
It's lovely to be back.
Well, this program is about spiritual classics, the writings that have added to our spiritual inheritance, and ones that have become influential, both within the tradition from which they emerged and also beyond that tradition. The tales of the Hasidim have become a kind of body of spiritual writing that many people like to quote, Jewish, Christian, Buddhist. I guess what we need to do first is to establish who were the Hasidim, what made them so appealing to so many people.
Well, Hasidism is a movement that took off really mainly in Eastern Europe in the second half of the 18th century and actually remained influential until today. Its founding figure was a very charismatic, very humble mystic called the Baal Shem Tov. And as the generations passed, he had disciples, he raised other disciples, until each town had its own Hasidic leader. So to this day, we know of Lubavitcher Hasidim, Bratslava Hasidim, Gera Hasidim, all known by their place of origin in Eastern Europe, but they've taken their name with them, of course, with the almost total destruction of Eastern European Jewry. Today they're found mainly in America and in Israel, though you have quite a few of them here in Australia.
Many of the tales of the Hasidim are attributed to the Baal Shem Tov, the founder. Has that tradition continued?
Yeah, it was a very powerful tradition. You see, Jewish life always has a tendency to become almost hyper-intellectual, the Talmudic study, which is formidably difficult. And that did create a cadre of leaders who, so the Baal Shem Tov and his followers felt, had lost touch with ordinary Jews. Hasidism was really a populist movement amongst ordinary Jews, amongst humble working-class people. And it focused on the virtues of ordinary people. And if you want to do that, storytelling is far and away the best way.
When did you first become acquainted with Hasidic tales?
As an undergraduate, you know, I was studying philosophy in Cambridge University, which led to all sorts of questions about faith. And I had this feeling that in America there were lots of very impressive rabbis. And I took a summer holiday away from university and traveled around the States. Now, everywhere I went, people said there is one leader that you must see, and that is Rabbi Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And this was coming to me from all shades of the religious spectrum. And so I walked into his headquarters in Brooklyn in 770 Eastern Parkway and said, I'd love to see the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Well, they collapsed laughing because there were thousands of people waiting to see the Rebbe, and you had to wait months, years, you know. However, I asked them to give it a try, and I told them where I'd be. I'd be in Los Angeles at a particular date, and if they were able to arrange it, please let me know. Well, they did. Of course, I was in Los Angeles on a Sunday when the phone call came through, and they said, the Rebbe can see you on Thursday. Now, I couldn't afford to travel anyway but by a Greyhound bus. So I traveled for 3 days from Los Angeles to New York on a Greyhound bus, and I got to see the Rebbe, a meeting which changed my life.
How so? Did he tell you a story?
Well, no, but he took me as a story. He challenged me. He said, what are you doing for Jewish life in your university? I said, well, I never thought of myself as leader. Why not? He said. We had this extraordinary situation of one of the most famous and sought-after Jewish leaders in the world, talking to an anonymous student from 3,000 miles away, challenging him to become a leader. I thought that was pretty impressive. Actually, it taught me something rather special. Good leaders create followers, but great leaders produce leaders. So I owe my involvement to the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who was not so much a storyteller, but understood that each one of us has a story, not just to tell, but also to live.
One of the features of Lubavitcher Hasidim that I recall is their love of joy and dancing and a kind of a joie de vivre that comes into the religious life that we often don't associate with the studious and the obedient and the prayerful.
Mm.
Did you encounter that?
Oh, absolutely. It's the most obvious thing about Lubavitch Hasidim and Hasidim generally. And in this, they were very true to the spirit of Judaism. If you read the Bible, you will see, for instance, towards the end of Deuteronomy, when Moses warns the people that bad things will happen if they drift away from their faith and way in life. And he says these bad things will happen because you didn't serve God with joy and fullness of heart out of the abundance of all things. Judaism, if you read it carefully in the Bible, is very much about celebrating this life done here on earth, the earth that God created and declared good. And the psalm says, serve God with joy, come before him in exaltation. So it was really the persecutions of the Middle Ages that transposed Judaism in what I call the minor key. But actually, deep down, it's a religion of celebration. And the Hasidim understood it. And my goodness me, they know how to do it.
There are so many stories that the Hasidim produced. Surely there must be one about joy and dancing.
Well, there is. It's told about the Baal Shem Tov that on Simchat Torah, which is the day in which we rejoice in the giving of the Torah, the law given to Moses at Sinai. And it's said that the Baal Shem Tov's disciples on this day made merry in his house. They danced and drank and had more and more wine brought up from the cellar. After some hours, the Baal Shem Tov's wife came up to his room and said, if they don't stop drinking, we soon won't have any wine left for all the rites of the Sabbath, the Kiddush and Havdalah, our services over which we have to have wine. He laughed and replied, you're right, so go and tell them to stop. She opened the door to the big room and she saw this. The disciples were dancing around in a circle, and around the dancing circle twined a blazing ring of blue fire. Then she herself took a jug in her right hand and a jug in her left, and motioning the servant away, went into the cellar. Soon after, she returned with the vessels full to the brim. And you know, a later master, Rav Nachman of Bratslav, once said, what is sorrow, sadness like? It's like somebody who stands at the side while everyone else is dancing. And you know the only way to defeat sorrow? Take hold of it, join hands with it, and make sorrow dance the dance.
Well, what you've identified there, what you've suggested there in that story, or what Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav actually suggested there, is that tremendous irony of life, that in the midst of sorrow, there is the potential for joy. Is that one of the reasons why the Hasidim and their tales have been so appealing to people, particularly when they're looking for inspiration?
Well, of course, you know, there was a whole school of what you might call hellfire preaching in Judaism, of, homileticists, sermonizers who would go from town to town preaching fear and awe and trembling. But, you know, the Baal Shem Tov took the opposite road, and he was quite right. You see, when somebody tells us our sins, we kind of clam up and our heart becomes closed. But when somebody takes us by the hand and says, let's sing together, let's dance together, let's say a l'chaim, let's drink a little wine or a little vodka, let's rejoice. When you do that, your heart opens. And once the heart is open, it can be filled with the Spirit of God.
Are there ways in which the Hasidic tradition gave permission, in a way, for the rabbi to appeal to his following or to touch the people in rather unorthodox ways, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, although even then you go right back to the Talmud, to the Tractate of Ketubot, and we discover that rabbis way, way back in the 3rd, 2nd, 3rd centuries would be incredibly exuberant at Jewish weddings, and they would dance before the bride, and some would do somersaults, and some would juggle, and all sorts of strange things which are totally unrabbinical. But they did it to create a moment of joy. In fact, if you go to the Bible itself, you'll read about how King David, when he brought the ark into Jerusalem, danced and whistled and sang, and his wife, Michal, Saul's daughter, took a very dim view of that indeed. That's not the kind of conduct becoming a king. And David refused to be chastened. And so David, to whom we attribute some of the most searing and sad psalms in the entire literature, nonetheless understood the importance of joy. And joy does, in fact, heal in a way that few other things do. It heals the wounds of the heart.
Rabbi Sacks, do you have some Hasidic tales that exhibit this, the way in which stories themselves can heal?
Yeah, stories do heal. You know, Elie Wiesel once said, God created humanity because God loves stories. And I thought that was a wonderful line. And of course, one of the great things about the Hasidim was that they saw the best in people, not the worst. If you ever want to know the difference between righteousness and self-righteousness, that is the difference. The self-righteous see the bad in people, but the righteous see the good. And I love the story told about one of the greatest of them all, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who once, on a Saturday, saw a Jew in the street smoking a cigarette. Now, you're really not allowed to smoke a cigarette on the Sabbath. So he went up to him and said, "Beloved Jew, surely you know that on the Sabbath you're not allowed to smoke a cigarette." And the Jew said, "I know that on Sabbath you're not allowed to smoke a cigarette." "Well, surely, inadvertently, you must have been unaware that actually you are smoking a cigarette." "No, I know I'm smoking a cigarette," said the fellow. "Then, dear friend, you must have forgotten that today is the Sabbath." "No," said the man, "I know perfectly well that today is the Sabbath." And Levi Yitzchak turned his eyes towards heaven and said, "Dear God, what a wonderful people you have. You give this man every chance to tell a lie, and he won't."
Now that's seeing the silver lining.
Hasidim taught us to see joy in sadness and good, sometimes in religious rebellion and sometimes in religious misery. And that's what really, I think, is their enduring charm to people of all faiths, because somehow they touched on a real truth in the human situation.
These stories come from a world that has vanished. Eastern European Jewry before the war. In the 20th century, these stories were really brought before Western eyes who had not known them before, by Martin Buber, largely. He was moved by them in a way, they reawakened something in him. But it's often said that what he saw in them was something equivalent to Christian mysticism. What do you say?
It's clear here that we have a unique literature, a unique literary genre, and it's got nothing to do whatsoever with Christian mysticism. There are overlappings between mysticisms in all the great faiths. I mean, there's some kinship between Jewish mysticism, for instance, and Sufi mysticism. Mysticism is a kind of universal human phenomenon. Of course, the Sufis have their own tales, as do the Zen masters and so on. And so mysticism does generate tales, but they all have a particular flavor. You can tell this is a Jewish one, this is a Buddhist one, and so on. You can tell quite simply, like listening to a piece of music that you've never heard before, but you can instantly say, "Well, that was written by Tchaikovsky." So they have a particular flavor, and I think they're unmistakable. And we do indeed owe Martin Buber and then others like Elie Wiesel for making them available to a much wider public.
What do you think is that unique flavor? What gives a Hasidic tale its unique stamp?
Number one, very often the heroes are very ordinary people. They're the people who would have been looked down on by the great rabbinic scholars. But the Hasidic rebbes befriended them and spoke lovingly about them. and as it were, a little like Rembrandt, you know, Rembrandt's portraits of people. He does not pick the beautiful or the famous. He picks ordinary people and shows their inner light. So I think Rembrandt, who probably didn't know any Hasidic stories, would have appreciated them. Secondly, very often they have a sense of humour. And thirdly, they have an almost intimate sense of the relationship between the holy and the everyday. In a Hasidic story, the holy isn't something set in a palace, on a throne. It's very close, and you'll find it the next door you walk through.
So has the world that produced those stories been swept away?
Yes and no, but storytelling continues. And of course, that itself is the subject of a very famous story. The Rizhina once said, the Baal Shem Tov would go into a forest, to a very holy place, and he would light a fire and say a prayer, and redemption would come. And then in the next generation, the Maggid of Mezrich no longer knew the prayer, but he remembered the place, and he lit a fire. And along came the Mezrich's disciple, who no longer knew how to light the fire, but at least he knew how to go to the place. And I, said the Rizhina, no longer even know the place, but I can still tell the story.
Indeed, and that's a particularly lovely one that has been told many times. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, you have a particular interest in the idea, the possibility, the belief in tikkun olam, to mend the world. Is that a theological or a sociological idea?
It's a theological idea. You cannot generate hope without a theology, because subtract the soul, the spirit, God from the universe, there is no reason whatsoever to think that this human story has a happy ending. So a kind of sociological or scientific, social scientific narrative is almost invariably a tragic one, to which the response is stoicism. Enjoy life as you can and don't take its knocks too seriously. You cannot generate hope from a godless universe. And I think the great Jewish gift, and it's there in the Bible, the prophets, it's there in the rabbinic literature, and it is certainly there in the tales of the Hasidim, is this extraordinary principle of hope. Jews are not optimists. We know too much tragedy. We shed too many tears. But no Jew ever lost hope. And it was no accident that the national anthem of the State of Israel is called Hatikva, the hope.
Jonathan Sacks, you've written that creation is God's great unfinished symphony, and he's entrusted us, humankind, with its completion. So, what's your advice on how we can all play in tune?
Look for the trace of God in everyone you meet. Say to yourself, that might just be one of those hidden, righteous individuals whose stories the Hasidim so often told. Because what they often so often showed us was that the least likely people were the ones most full of God's light. So learn to see other human beings that way. Train yourself to think that maybe I am here, in this place, in these circumstances, at this time, because God needs me to do something. That I am actually part of God's script, that I'm one of the characters in his story. And ask yourself at each singular moment in your life, what is he calling on me to do right now? Now those two things will actually change your attitude to the world. The first will help you to heal the people that you meet, and the second will fill your life with a sense of meaning. And those two things will allow each of us, in our own little way, which is the only way there is, to heal a fractured world.
Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, from your mouth to God's ears, as they say, thank you so much.
Don't forget, God is listening, because God loves stories.
The Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, Jonathan Sacks, speaking there about Hasidic tales. With the Spirit of Things on ABC Radio National and online. And this is our Spiritual Classic series, heard at the beginning of the month. This year, we've selected writings that have been hugely popular, both within and outside the tradition from which they emerged. The tales of the Hasidim are an example of that. Donna Jacob Seif uses them in situations of conflict and grief, and to help communicate where arguments just won't work. Donna Jacob Seif, you're a storyteller. How would you use a Hasidic tale in the contexts in which you work as a counselor, as a dialogue worker? What sort of tale would work for you?
Well, I don't find that the Hasidic tales are specifically for a Jewish audience, certainly. I use them all the time because they seem to hold within them the very best way of saying what I want to say. So there's one story that I tell to nurses or counselors or therapists, but also would suggest that those people use it to their clients for ways of relating and learning how to listen. And this is the story. It's by Nachum of Breslev, who was the great Hasidic storyteller, the great-grandson of the Baal Shem Tov, whose stories are so revered by the followers of the Breslover rabbi that they are looked at in the same way, in many respects, as Torah, with the same rigor and the same scholarly approach. And this is one of them. It's called The Rooster Prince. There was once a king and queen who had a son who was the apple of their eye. Nothing was spared this boy. The greatest chefs and tailors and teachers, so that one day he would be a fine king. But one day something happened to that boy just as he was becoming a man. He woke up one morning and he thought he was a rooster. He took off all his clothes, he got under the table, ate crumbs off the floor, flapped his arms like wings and crowed. It was a disaster. The king tried everything, healers and doctors and wise men, advisors. No one could help until one day an old man with a long beard came to see the king and he said, "Let me have a week with your son. I think I can help." And the king was grateful for any advice. And so the old man was brought into the banquet hall where the prince was under the table, and then the door was closed behind him. The first thing the old man did was take off all his clothes and get under the table with the prince. He put his arms like wings, went around crowing, eating food off the floor, and the prince looked up and he said, "Who are you?" And he said, I'm a rooster. Who are you?" And the prince said, "I'm a rooster too." He was so thrilled to have a bit of company. And all day they just crumbed and flapped and crowed. And the next day the old man got up and he put some clothes on and he went back under the table. And the prince looked and said, What are you doing? Roosters don't wear clothes." The old man said, "That's true, but I was cold. And just because I'm wearing clothes doesn't mean I'm not a rooster." And the prince was a little cold too, so he put on his clothes. Next day, the old man was walking around the room. "What are you doing?" said the prince. "Roosters don't walk like that." "That's true," said the old man, "but my back was sore, and just because I'm walking like this doesn't mean I'm not a rooster." The next day they ate fine food. The next day at the table with knife and fork. And by the end of the week they were dressed in fine nobleman's clothes, sitting at the table, eating beautiful food and discussing ways of running a kingdom, justice and ethics and philosophy. And halfway through the conversation, the young boy said, What are we doing? Roosters don't talk like this. And the old man said, it's true, but I'm enjoying the conversation. And just because we're talking like this doesn't make us not roosters. And so at the end of that day, the old man stood up and he said to the prince, I'm going to leave you now, but let me leave you with a little advice. Out there in the world, there are a lot of enemies of roosters. Take my advice. Don't tell everyone that you're a rooster. And the prince became a wonderful king, and no one ever knew that he was really a rooster.
How do you use that story, say, in a situation of dialogue?
Well, you know, in difficult conversations where you stand apart or across from the other, if you like, and that their story is so different to the story that you have been nurturing and growing inside you, it's a way for me to image this taking off my clothes, getting rid of anything that is me, getting under the table with them and just allowing myself to listen, to see from their perspective, under the table, without the clothes, flapping their wings, what it is that they are coming from. If I can imagine it, as much as I can imagine it, that story gives me the strength to do it. How to listen in a way which will heal.
Donna, one of the issues facing us now, apart from interfaith dialogue, is also the environment. And in fact, many people from different religious traditions are getting together, as it were, on that issue and others like it. Is there a Hasidic tale that would help people come together and understand what are some of the essential values?
There are so many beautiful tales about the relationship between man and nature, or human and nature, in the Hasidic tradition. The Baal Shem Tov himself understood the language of birds. There are many stories about that, as did King Solomon, this motif which suggests this deep understanding of nature and the natural world. But the story that comes to mind is actually a contemporary tale, if you like. The Hasidic stories tell of the leaders of the movement and their lives, and in doing so create mystery and a way of understanding the world. But there are modern Hasidic masters who also have stories about them. One is Rabbi Cook, who was the first rabbi of modern Israel, who was a great mystic and a Hasidic rabbi. And there is a famous story about him walking with his disciple or his student. And as they were walking along, the student just pulled a leaf off a tree as they were walking, and Rabbi Cook was visibly shaken. And the student asked him what was wrong, and Rabbi Cook said, "Believe me when I say that I never inadvertently, without reason, take a leaf from a tree or even a blade of grass, because all of nature is as it should be by God. And don't you know that every blade of grass has an angel above it singing, 'Grow, grow,' and everything made by God, even rocks, have their song to sing." There's also stories about the relationship between human and the material world, which I think has something to say about the environmental kind of issue as well. For instance, there's a beautiful story about a young man who goes to the door of a rabbi and knocks, and he looks in when the rabbi opens the door and sees that the room is completely bare. There's no furniture at all, not a skerrig of anything. And the young man says to the rabbi, "Rabbi, where is all your furniture?" And the rabbi says to him, "Well, where is yours?" And the young man says, "But I'm visiting." And the rabbi says, "So am I." It's almost a Zen kind of idea in a way, this non-attachment to things, which comes from the Hasidic tradition, I think, because poverty was such a strong challenge to try and overcome, that this idea that faith can transcend any kind of poverty or suffering is a strong motive in Hasidic tales and speaks to the world today as clearly as ever.
Donna, Jonathan Sacks talked about these tales as being unique, as having a unique stamp. Do you find in the world of storytelling, which is the world you inhabit, that they are unique, or are there connections to stories from other traditions?
I think that there are absolutely connections to other traditions, and that the values or the ideas that they're trying to impart are universal. But there is a uniqueness about them too. There is the place, the character, sometimes the way it's told, the self-deprecation or the humour at oneself or the shtetl kind of feel. There is a uniqueness that I wouldn't want to rob them of, and yet, pared down, the story itself could be from any of the mystical traditions, without a doubt.
These are, of course, Jewish tales, and Jews told them to each other and still do. How do you feel about people telling them who aren't Jewish, who use them in another context, perhaps a Christian context or a Muslim context?
Beautiful. I think that, first of all, I tell stories from different traditions so that I can enhance the different traditions. It's not an appropriation. It's a way of being able to say, this is a Hasidic story, and it still says something to me. I think that's beautiful. It's not denying the source of it, but it's expanding the application of it, which is good.
Do you think the story, then, is the most essential way of communicating a religious truth?
I think it is certainly a way of communicating human truth, first and foremost. And then, if you look at the source and you're true to its flavour, then it's also telling someone of the religious truth. But I think first and foremost, it's a humanistic truth that all stories tell. There's one story that I think about all the time at the moment in our world today that I tell, and it wants to be told, so I'll tell it to you. It's also Nachum of Breslev. It's a story that begins with an advisor going to the king and saying to him, "Your Majesty, I have heard something terrible. The harvest of next year is going to send everybody mad." King says, "What do you advise?" "Well, there is enough harvest from last year," the advisor said, "for you and for me." And the king thought about it for a while, and he said, "You advise me to eat from last year's harvest while my entire kingdom goes mad? That doesn't suit me at all. In the end, they will think we're the mad ones." He said, "No, what we need to do is also eat from next year's harvest, but we will mark our foreheads. And whenever we see each other, you and I will remind each other that we are mad." And when I have conversations with my friends, looking at the world and shaking our heads in wonder at what we see, I'll often tell them, "You see, we're reminding each other that we're mad." It's a way of being able to remember, look, we are complicit with this world. We live in it. It's part of us. We vote and we see what is around us. And we become moved and changed by the society in which we live, whether we're aware of it or not. But if we are able to remind each other every now and again that we're mad, that's at least something that we can do.
Well, I think there's a bit of truth in that madness. Donna Jacobside, thank you so much for coming onto The Spirit of Things and bringing your harvest of stories with you.
Thank you.
Donna Jacobside is a professional storyteller based in Sydney. And if you'd like to hear those stories again on your personal player or online, just put The Spirit of Things into your search engine. We're hearing about Hasidic tales on our Spiritual Classics series. The next program in this series will be on the first Sunday of April, when we look at the popular interest in the spiritual exercises of Saint Ignatius. Nothing could be further from the spontaneous, exuberant, and often quirky tales of the Hasidim. They combine the mysticism of the Jewish Kabbalah with the piety of village life in Eastern Europe. And that's where Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi hails from. And at 82, he's still keeping the flame of Hasidism alive, but in a newer fashion, which he calls Jewish renewal. Reb Zalman has always been something of a rebel, just like the founder of Hasidism, the Baal Shem Tov, which means master of the good name.
he's the master of the good name. And in those days, it was very clear that if you knew the proper names of God, of angels, and so on and so forth, you can change and transform reality. So when people needed healing and all these things, they would come to the Baal Shem Tov. However, there were some people who were just Baal Shem and not Baal Shem Tov. And that was a very important shift for him, because he was not merely interested in individuals. He wanted to really create a change. And he needed to create the change because in a vision, the Messiah told him that when his teachings are going to reach the masses, he will make it possible for the Messiah to come.
Who was this Baal Shem Tov before he actually assumed such an important name?
Well, I tell you, that would take me into another story about his life before this life, because among Hasidim there's a wonderful tale about how he was a secret saint who nobody knew about in this life before the last one, when he appeared as a Baal Shem Tov. So it's not the first thing, but he was an orphan. His parents had died when he was young. His father told him he need not be afraid of anything but God. And there were some good people who raised him. And he had all kinds of professions, from being what I would call the school bus for the cheder, taking the children from home and bringing them to the teaching. Many wonderful tales are told about that. What made him at the age of 36, as it were, come out and be known, was because he had been delegated to do that from heaven. And it was necessary because most of the people in Europe at that time, we are talking about the late 1700s when the Baal Shem Tov began to work. And so I would say that about 1734 is when he came out. At that point, it was that you had an elite of Torah scholars, and the rest of the people were somehow depressed and oppressed, and they wanted to serve God, but there were all kinds of preachers who would come and tell them how sinful they were, and the Baal Shem Tov gave them joy, and that's how the Hasidic movement began.
What does Hasidus actually mean?
It originally comes from being kind to God. Most people are grudging to God. Chesed is kindness, joy, and offering that. In other words, to do more than is required, to do that which comes from the heart rather than that which is demanded by law.
And is that the difference between his message, the Baal Shem Tov's message, and the rabbis around at the time? Was he emphasizing something different than the law?
That's really so, because he brought back a teaching that the rabbis of the Talmud had, that God desires the heart. Rachmana liba bai. God desires the heart. And so they were dealing with how God really only desires the head. And the Baal Shem Tov brought that back and brought joy, and simple people came to him, and his disciples had to learn from him how to relate to the simple people.
And are we talking about Poland, or how far in Eastern Europe did this movement spread?
Well, it began in the corner in which Galicia, or the Western Ukraine, goes, and it spread into Eastern Ukraine, and spread into Poland, and spread into White Russia, and spread even to Lithuania, Polesia, Hungary, Romania. It was like a starburst. If you sometimes see fireworks, when they have exploded, then they explode again. And so every generation, there were more and more people who followed the Baal Shem Tov's way and became empowered to teach other people.
Now, in traditional Judaism, the leader or the teacher is called a rabbi.
Rabbi is a title for anyone who has mastered the work and has been ordained. In other words, he has been given a license to teach what is kosher, what is not kosher. When we are talking about the Rebbe, we are talking about somebody who can guide souls to God. And the way Hasidim talk about that, they say the Rebbe is a general soul. The clusters around him are the ones who derive divine influx because they're connected with the Rebbe.
So in Hasidism, the teacher is the Rebbe, not the rabbi.
That's right.
There's also the tzaddik. Now, many people have read about the tzaddik. He's wise. He's also miraculous. Is that also specific to Hasidism?
It's just another word for Rebbe. We would speak of Harav HaTzaddik when we discuss Rebbe, and it's a synonym for Rebbe.
In Melbourne and Sydney today, in fact, around the world, one would see Jews who go to the synagogue on Friday night, but they look different. They're wearing what seem to be old-fashioned clothes. The men always wear black. They have black hats. They may even be wearing a frock coat from perhaps the 18th century. Why is that?
In every tradition, you find the people who represent the religion and the tradition to wear traditional clothes. And so nowadays, people wear everything that's in fashion. But in the past, every ethnic group wore different clothes. In fact, you were able to tell from which province of that ethnic group they came because of the clothes that they wore. It is important for Hasidim to be identifiable as Hasidim. And so that's why they wear those clothes. And very often you can tell, you can say, I see by your outfit that you are a Lubavitcher, right?
Now, Lubavitcher. Lubavitchers are a particular stream of Hasidism.
The city in White Russia, in the Vitebsk neighborhood, it was called the city of brotherly love, Lubavitch. That's what it means. And that's where the Rebbe was located before the Russian Revolution. In fact, before the First World War. During the First World War, the Rebbe Reb Sholem Baer fled Lubavitch. He did not want to be under the German rule and died in Rostov on the Don. His son, Reb Yosef Yitzchak, became the next leader. And he was my main teacher, if I were to speak of him this way. I loved him dearly, and I felt that I could follow him to the ends of the earth. And when you see these young people today who have come here, that means that they have come here because they want to spread a message to Jews who have lost so much of the content and the intent of Judaism during the Holocaust and during assimilation. And so this is the work that they're doing, and it's remarkable.
One of the most popular, perhaps the most beloved aspects of Hasidism is its penchant for tales, for the story. Was the Baal Shem Tov a storyteller?
That's how he began. That's how he attracted his first great student, Yaakov Yosef of Polonnoy, with stories. And he first didn't understand why stories should be important, because they had a sense they're just mere stories. But the Zohar makes it very clear, anyone who reads the Torah as if it were mere stories misses the point.
Now, the Zohar, of course, is the central mystical text of the Kabbalah.
Of the Kabbalah, right. It is a commentary on the Torah from the inside. There is outer teaching and there's inner teaching. Kabbalah represents what Hasidim would call Pnimiyut HaTorah, the inner teachings of the Torah.
Can you give me an example of a Hasidic tale that sort of is pithy?
Very simple. One man comes to the Rebbe de Tzemach Tzedek. He was the third in the row of Lubavitch Rebbes. And complained, he said, I set up a conventicle for the people and I make sure they should be warm, they should have everything, and the people are stepping on me. Rebbe, what should I do? And the Rebbe said, who asked you to spread yourself all over? That wherever one steps, one has to step on you. Or another one, the way in which the Rebbe said, we believe really in reincarnation, but only a fool waits to die before he starts the next one.
Now, that truly is mystical. I think one of my most favorite Hasidic tales is about the poor, ignorant Shlemiel, as it were, who doesn't know Hebrew, who comes to the synagogue and is told, just say all sorts of words that come into your mind. God will rearrange them in a prayer.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful tale, in which the Baal Shem Tov welcomed a man who had lost his prayer book and was just reciting the alphabet for God and say, you put it together for me. Yes. There's something that I would like to add here. One of the important things of what a Hasid wants from his master, from his Rebbe, is a blessing. And the world is under-blessed today. And by connecting with the thought and the melody of the Rebbe and with the other Hasidim, one sort of logs on to the blessing possibility for people. And so I'd like your hearers, through that, also to be logged on to the blessing possibilities of Hasidism.
But hasn't Hasidism also been its own worst enemy? I mean, in some ways, one could say that it too has fallen into traditionalism and perhaps an overemphasis on the externals.
That takes us into a much longer conversation than we can handle right now. After the Holocaust, we needed to rebuild infrastructure, and we had to make sure that there would be schools, and that there should be kosher meat, and there should be synagogues, and that talitot should be here, and prayer books be printed, and all that stuff. That brings us to the outside of things. My hope and my trust is that once we have our external situation rebuilt enough to be able to grow from the inside, you will see Hasidism in its way have a resurgence. Jewish renewal is some way an outgrowth of that Hasidism.
And Jewish renewal is what you have founded.
That's right.
Can you describe?
What can I say more about it? Well, first of all, it is post-triumphalist. It sees itself ecumenically involved with other religions. It is ecological. It is feminist in this way. So women are ordained and share in the teaching.
But that goes against Hasidism.
Well, it depends, because there was a very great Hasidic master, a woman by the name of Chana Rochel of Ludmir, and her story deserves to be told. We recently found her grave in Jerusalem and built a new stone there, a new memorial for her. She was very special. There were other Hasidic women that were great, but they were wives of Rebbes, just as Rebbes Malke, for instance, was of the Belzer Rebbe, and so on and so forth. In fact, to begin with the Baal Shem Tov, his daughter Adel was much more his heir than his son Tzvi.
Tell me about the importance of music and dancing in Hasidism. One thinks of klezmer music.
Well, I think klezmer music is a takeoff from the devotional part of Hasidic music. We sing in a way of devotion. So when you call and you say, this is a nigun, a dveikut nigun, this is a nigun that comes with that, with a deep feeling. So it begins with saying, what I have to say to God, I don't even have the right words for, but my song, my prayer will do it. On the other hand, there's also the happy stuff, that all my bones shall shout, who is like you, O Lord, and that comes up in the dancing. And that's wonderful too.
Reb Zalman Schachter Shalomi is based in Boulder, Colorado, in the United States. And if you're interested in the tales of the Hasidim, the collection edited by Martin Buber is still available, although it's been surpassed and critiqued by many other collections. I hope you enjoy this edition of Spiritual Classics, which you can hear on the first Sunday and Tuesday of the month. And as I mentioned, the next one is on the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius, the founder of the Jesuits. The program was produced by me and Jeff Wood, and sound engineering this week was provided by Judy Rapley. Next week, we're going on campus, where students cultivate their religious identity in student associations. It's all the go, and it's done to a hip-hop beat. It's Religion on Campus, next week on The Spirit of Things, with me, Rachel Kahn.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.